This is Earwax. I'm sorry. One more time. This is Earwax, an Amoeba Music podcast. Welcome to Earwax. We're Hillary and Cody, and this is Amoeba's very first podcast ever.
What up?
Great start.
Yes.
Yes.
Nailing it.
Cody and I have been working on this for a very long time, and we are have really been looking forward to making this episode.
It's good for it to see the light of day.
It's been a wild ride.
Hell yeah.
Okay. Maybe we should talk about what Amoeba is.
Sure. So Amoeba is the world's largest independent record store, and there are three locations. Hollywood is the youngest.
Yes.
And the first two were in Berkeley was first, and then San Francisco was second, and then Hollywood, I think it is in 2001 is when it opened.
Yeah. Rounds it out to three.
Rounds it out to three.
Amoeba is... like Cody said, it's the biggest independent record store in the world, but it's also really famous for putting on shows and live events with some of the greatest artists of all time and directors and authors, etc.
We've had Lana Del Rey, Steve Earle, David Lynch was there.
All across the board.
Paul McCartney, no big deal.
Yeah, just throw him in at the end there. Yeah.
We're going to do a lot of name dropping on this show.
Yeah.
And I have encountered basically none of these people personally, but I'm going to use their names.
That is a lie, because you definitely have encountered some of these people.
Yeah, some of I definitely have. I'm pretty connected.
But it's more about the fact we're both huge fans. So if anything, we're just appreciating the time that we've been able to have at this store, appreciating the opportunities that came with it.
How did you... first hear about Amoeba, and then how did you begin working at Amoeba? 10 years ago.
Yeah.
A decade ago.
Yeah, really. So, as you know, Cody, I'm a big video game enthusiast. And around the time that Guitar Hero World Tour came out, I was real deep in the thick of it. I was really good at the time too. I'm not anymore. But when that game came out, Amoeba was a playable location, and I just thought it was really cool. I love the idea of a record store that you could play at, especially because the more research I did on Amoeba, the more I realized that it's more than just a record store. It's like a cultural hub for everybody who's super interested in film or music or anything related to that culture. It's sort of a meeting ground for everybody to get together and discuss and exchange ideas and artists, etc. So I became really interested in it. And then it took me a long time to go to either of the Bay Area stores. I'm originally from the Bay Area, but I had never been to an Amoeba location until I moved to Southern California. And when I did, my very first roommate was listing off things for us to do in the area. And when she dropped the name Amoeba, I cut her off real quick. And I was like, there's an Amoeba nearby. We have to go right now. And the second I walked into that store, it's enormous. If anybody has never seen a picture of the store, I encourage you to look it up, because it doesn't look like most record stores. It's really big. And it felt like many people say, a Disneyland for adults. The energy was so, it was like buzzing with this energy of everybody who was super interested in whatever they were looking at, you know, or everybody talking to each other passionately about things that they cared about. And I remember feeling like I want to work here. But I want to experience that. I want to be a part of that. And I turned in my resume to Robert at the information desk, who has become a very good friend of mine since. And I remember that he gave my resume to one of the owners, and I thought I would never hear back again. And I heard back like a week later, and I think I started like screaming. I was so excited because I think there is this idea, and maybe it's just, you know, imposter syndrome about feeling like, am I good enough? Am I smart enough? Do I know enough? Do I care enough? And I feel like I do, but they don't know me. And feeling seen for that was really exciting. And I felt like when I first started working at Amoeba, this sense of acceptance that was like, I do belong here. And I do care about these things like these people around me do, and we can all sort of build off of one another and learn from one another.
Yeah, that's great.
Right.
it's true. That, like that energy that you talk about, if, I mean, Amoeba as a microcosm of Los Angeles, if Amoeba and Los Angeles are anything, they are alive.
Yeah.
There is, yeah.
Loud.
And that gathering spot of people with common interests, shared interests, but also radically different interests. I mean, there's folks that love vinyl who will only spend time in the jazz room. There's folks that love vinyl who will only spend time in the punk section. But there's a sense of community, a shared common interest. And that I just think that is such a wonderful thing. And to have that in such a space like Amoeba, be it Berkeley, San Francisco, or Hollywood, is incredible, because you get that, but you're also a live music venue. Mm-hmm. You're a spot where people stop in and do signings. People like who are doing shows in the area drop by and pick up their favorite record. That's great.
How about you, Cody?
I worked at a small record store in Springfield, Missouri in college, and my boss would talk about Amoeba because he would come out to LA and he would mention it and just how big it was and how overwhelming it was. So I came out here to visit in 2015 and had just like a couple hours to spend one day, and walked in and was overwhelmed. This was when we were on the Sunset location. Mm-hmm. We're on Hollywood Boulevard now. So I was at the old Sunset location, and it was just, it's just so, as overwhelming as it is, it's also incredibly inviting, where it's mm-hmm. just like, come on in and hit the bins. And that's what I did. And I moved out to LA about a year later, did a whole bunch of different jobs that were not nearly as fun, and then applied for a security position. And they were like, actually, you have record store experience. Would you like to work on the floor? And I was like, yes, please. Would much prefer that. And so I started about 4.5 years ago, and then moved to the web side of things, Amoeba.com, about 2.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I work on the website, helping fulfill orders, customer service, all that good stuff. It's a killer place to work. I mean, having part of your job include seeing those live acts that we mentioned, it's just, what a treat, what a benefit. You know, and the sense of community that's inherent to a position like that, it's pretty rare. And I'm really thankful to have found a place that I can mesh my hobby of collecting vinyl with work, which is, I mean, it revolves around talking about music. It's great.
Totally agree. That is my favorite thing about working there, is just all the people that you encounter, the people that work there alongside you every day, and the people that come there from all over the world just to see what it's like every single day. Everybody's in there for one reason, and the reason is because we're all interested in a common thing, and we all want to talk to somebody about it or learn more about it, you know? And that's sort of the beauty in coming into a store like that. We were just talking about this story where Boy Genius recently stopped by the store to surprise everybody for this listening party we were having. And Phoebe Bridgers told this story on stage about how when she thinks of Amoeba, she thinks of this time where she was young and she ditched school to come into the store, and like that sense of freedom that comes with it and exploration. And that's, I think, the best part, especially as a customer, about coming into the store is just there's so much to go through, and you could never, ever get to the bottom of every genre and every album.
Obviously, this is the pilot episode, so we're going to stretch our legs a little bit here on the front end. We've told you a little bit about ourselves and Amoeba, but going forward, the idea is to have a show that brings you plenty of Amoeba news and in-store updates for all three of our locations. And then the meat of each episode, we're going to take an album and we're going to look at its story. And we're going to try and tell this album's story, you know, things that went into its making, little gems of anecdotes behind certain albums, and also where it fits and how it affected in our pop culture history and in our history in general. We've talked a lot about it, and I'd like to emphasize that we're not going to trash records. We're not here to give anything a rating. We know that there's going to be records that we speak on that don't personally click with us, but that's okay because they do click with somebody, and probably many somebodies. And we're here to tell you why we think it's important for people to know these records and why people find joy in them, because they do. Everything that we're going to talk about here, there's a lot of people that have loved these records and love these records. And we're going to bring an element of respect and enthusiasm to everything we cover.
We mentioned that Amoeba is sort of famous for doing a lot of live events and store events. And those include things like concerts and signings and contests, sometimes listening parties for new albums that are coming out or raffles. So we want to make sure that you guys are kept updated on everything that's happening in advance. So if you keep listening to this podcast, you should know about everything happening in every store location before it happens.
And after it happens.
Yeah. And every week we'll also be telling you which albums are going to be coming out for the upcoming week in a physical copy, which is different from it being released digitally. They often have different release dates.
Part of what we want to do with this show, Earwax, is we want to bring some of that exploration to the folks that maybe can't come into Amoeba or can't come in as frequently as they would like, mm-hmm. or just want to hear two record store clerks talk about records.
Yeah, geek out a little bit. Exactly. And our intention is to take an album and put it directly into the time that it was made, tell the story of how and why it was made, because some of our favorite albums that we've found over our time working in record stores, we really began to connect more and more with when we understood exactly what they came from.
Yeah, and what they meant and how they were made and all those interesting little anecdotes that's behind them. The last little bit that I would add to that is that there are a select number of records that are considered like titans among the titans.
Yes.
The Kind of Blue, Shape of Jazz to Come, Abbey Road, like Dark Side of the Moon, those kind of records, initially at mm-hmm. least, we're going to punt.
It's not our priority.
Not our priority, yes. Because they're just such behemoths. Mm-hmm. Those records have been covered to death for good reason. And what we would like to do is try and dig just a touch deeper. And eventually, we're going to get to those.
Yes.
But those will be special.
Exactly. It's more about shining a spotlight on records that we feel are maybe just one tier below that in popularity that maybe deserve their due just the same.
Yeah. And that's all. That's all I've got.
Yeah.
So this show's going to rule, basically.
Great.
Oh, shit. And this week, we're going to be talking about our first album of the week is Bad Girls by Donna Summer. Okay, let's focus. Let's recenter ourselves. Mm-hmm. And let's sit down. We're sitting down to talk about Donna Summer's Bad Girls. Sad Girls. This album came out April 25th, 1979. It is the seventh studio album in her catalog. It is produced by longtime collaborators Giorgio Moroder and Pete Bellotti, and also one of the major players behind this who did the arrangements was Harold Faltermeyer.
We also filed Donna Summer in the soul section of the store, but there's a lot of controversy around exactly which genre you can pin her as an artist down, but specifically this album down as.
Yeah, because we do have a disco section that's separate from soul. She does kind of bounce in between the two. I think that either one is accurate, although, and you can maybe correct me if I'm wrong, the disco section of our store trends more towards like
electronic.
Yeah, more electronic stuff. And her stuff, especially like this record, is more like soul based.
She would say that she's more of a rock artist, especially surrounding this record, but a lot of that too has to do with the idea that Donna Summer was getting pinned down as a disco artist as disco was budding as a genre.
Oh, it was, yeah.
And she became so heralded for her disco songs that people sort of started forgetting about all of the other genres that she encompassed.
Yeah, this record is relative to where disco goes from here. It is more soul than what follows it. But yeah, there's elements of rock for sure in this record. A really quick Cliff's Notes on Donna Summer. She grew up singing in church. She was heavily influenced by Mahalia Jackson. She moved to Germany and performed in a touring production of Hair. And she was a session vocalist. That's where she met up with Giorgio Moroder and Pete Bellotti. They had a few moderate hits before their huge breakthrough in 1975, which was a song called Love to Love You Baby. It's a huge, huge disco hit.
You've definitely heard this song.
It's like, what, 17? There's at least like one 17-minute cut. Pretty groundbreaking. This she then cuts like a string of concept albums. This is, I've seen some people go back and forth about whether this is a concept record or not. If it is, in my opinion, it's a very loose interpretation of the word concept album. It doesn't really follow a narrative. It's, for me, it's like a bunch of different perspectives on sex and sex work, as opposed to like one straight through narrative.
Story, yeah.
This album, it comes out in a time, so 1979, disco is just on the other side of its peak. You have punk is more than established. New wave is burgeoning. Disco is still extremely, extremely prominent and probably dominant. I want to read this. There's this article or an essay that I read by an author named Gillian Frank. This is just some statistics about where disco is in 1979. In 1979, 25,000 discotheques in the United States. It was generating $6 billion a year. There were over 200 all disco radio stations with employing 8,000 DJs. That's just a tremendous amount of money. It accounted for nearly 30% of the entire music business and almost 40% of the top 100 hits. So disco is a titan at this point.
And Giorgio Moroder himself is also a titan of the disco genre. People have pinned Donna Summer as a disco artist by now. They have also pinned Giorgio Moroder as some sort of disco collaborator or disco savant, as well as electronic. If you're not familiar with Moroder's work, you've probably heard a lot of his stuff sampled, especially if you listen to hip hop. He's been sampled. His music has been sampled by the likes of DJ Shadow and Outkast, J Dilla, Rick Ross, MF Doom. The list goes on and on and on. But you've certainly probably heard at least a sample of his music, if not a major collaboration, most of which happened through Donna Summer.
Yeah, pretty much any of her big hits that aren't She Works Hard for the Money were produced by Giorgio Moroder and Pete Bellotti. He also, I mean, he did the soundtrack for Scarface. Mm-hmm. He co-wrote some of the songs for Top Gun. Like, he's everywhere. I like this record. You mentioned earlier that it's like kind of rock influenced. And this record is rooted in disco, but it shows an awareness of the changes that are coming down the road that we're going to touch on later, the rapid decline of disco. But it shows a knowledge of the like kind of a rock resurgence and the fading out of disco. And Donna Summer really steps into this role of branching out. Mm-hmm. And she does so really beautifully, and it's an intention. She was trying to shake off the idea of being the queen of disco.
On top of that, though, she really puts her best foot forward with this record that is 15 tracks long, and she co-wrote and even helped produce on like 8 out of 15 of those tracks, which for a female musician at the time was practically unheard of. She learned it all herself, and she was just so collaborative and so interested in the music that she was making. Moroder has come out many times and said that a lot of that was just Donna. You know, she knew exactly what she was doing and why she was doing it.
Yeah, I've seen both he and Pete Bellotti talk about her being a one-take vocal artist, where she would just be chatting it up in the studio and say, like, we're doing it right now. She would go in, hit the track, the vocal track in one take, and that was it. And that's impressive whenever you listen to these tracks and really her discography in general. These are not easy songs to sing. What's so great about this type of like disco and disco pop is like it feels easy and it feels simple because it's, you know, geared towards sounding that way. But what she's doing is a lot of work.
It's vocally very exhausting. But on top of that, the production on this record is excellent. I cannot speak enough about, especially the transitions between songs are so well articulated and well thought out that every time I hear a song change over on this album, I'm just excited to hear that stinger where it flows flawlessly into the next one where you can barely tell the difference.
Yeah, that flowing from one track into the next, when you talk to like house DJs or disco DJs, the idea of taking the crowd on a journey is like this thing that is referenced all the time. And I don't know necessarily that it comes from Donna Summer and the work with Giorgio Moroder and Pete Bellotti, but it's definitely influenced by that, because this record and her other stuff too, they do all flow into each other. And it is like, especially the first two sides, just feels like one long DJ set. That's totally just like banger after banger after banger. It's crazy. I would talk about the artwork just for a second. An iconic cover, her on the front with what would you, just like a slip?
Yeah,
like a nightgown.
It's just, yeah, I mean, it looks like, yes, a slip is what I would call it.
And then there's just a candid, like the front cover and the inner sleeves have just different shots of her as a sex worker in various, I don't know what, like various scenes.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the making of that album cover. It was
excellent.
Great. It was the photographer was Harry Langdon Jr. And he's come out and talked about it a lot since. And first of all the actors on the cover of this record, and it's a gatefold. So you open it up and there's more pictures on the inside, and they're all part of her staff working on this album.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yes, totally. Apparently they shot all day and night for this record cover, and she was having everybody put on these little mini plays containing the themes of the album. And she even sent her assistant to a junkyard to have a car disassembled that they could use as the interior dashboard and windshield for the shot on the back cover. Whoa. And it's her assistant's hand on the steering wheel holding the cigarette cover. Yeah,
that is badass.
Totally. But she had this... we talked about how, is this a concept album? Isn't it a concept album? She claims it to be a concept album, and that means something to her. So, you know, whatever this means to the listener, it still has in my mind that if this all tells her story from her perspective, sure, then I feel that's fairly valid.
Yeah.
I will say it's so... Each one of her concept albums is usually inspired by something that, like you were saying, she'll just be in the booth and it'll just happen. And she's constantly sourcing these themes and ideas from things that happen in real life. And for this particular album, she had sent her assistant out to run an errand for her. And her assistant was a woman who was dressed in business attire, just going through a shady part of Hollywood where we're working. And she ran into some cops who started catcalling her, and she ended up feeling violated and running away from them. And when she came back to Donna and complained about this, Donna got really worked up about the idea of, why do women have to constantly fear for their lives or feel uncomfortable just for walking outside? This woman's wearing full business attire. She shouldn't feel threatened or uncomfortable. And then it started spinning her wheels about sex work in a way that wasn't really talked about at the time as much as it is now, and the lack of justification for people who are just doing a job. And it sort of birthed the song Bad Girls in general, and the entire album from that one scenario.
And the well, we're going to talk about Hot Stuff here in just a second, because that 1-2 punch is incredible. But Bad Girls as a song is so great because, like, that toot toot and that beep beep, that's just, that was her after the track had been laid down. She was like, you know what, this needs something. And her thought was like, what do men do when they're trying to pick up a sex worker? They honk their horn. Mm-hmm. And so she went back in and laid that down. This song, Bad Girls, was she wrote it before the album, and she submitted it. She wrote a couple of years before the Bad Girls album, and she gave it to the head of Casablanca Records, Neil Bogart, and he thought that it should go to Cher.
Mm-hmm.
And Donna Summer was like, absolutely not.
Yes.
I'm going to shelve this. And then when she was making, during the Bad Girls sessions, I think either she refound it or somebody found those demos and
showed it to Marauder, and
they're like, here you go.
We can make something out of this.
We can make something out of this. For sure. I would like to hear the Cher version of that song.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's been so influential on culture. I actually found something when we were looking into this album, how Lil' Kim, her big album, the Notorious K.I.M. from 2000, was supposed to have a cover of Bad Girls on it with a RuPaul feature that is available. You can find it on the internet still, but the song was leaked before the album came out, so they pulled it from the album entirely, and now it doesn't exist on any album.
Wow.
Yeah. And even if there was this big TV special called the Donna Summer Special. And it technically had this Bad Girls music video interwoven. It was like a live music video. And one of the three sex workers in the music video is played by Twiggy.
No.
Yeah. It's like a huge, yeah. One of the most influential models of all time.
Played by Twiggy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's back up. Just to scotch. We'll talk about Hot Stuff. This is the intro track of the album. It's a total banger. I like to talk about intro tracks as the tone setter for the album. And it does a wonderful job of setting the tone for the rest of the record. We talked about earlier them wanting to expand the horizons of like who Donna Summer was as an artist, incorporating rock elements. This song does that so beautifully. Mm. The guitar solo is played by Skunk Baxter from a yacht rock legend from Steely Dan. And Doobie Brothers. He was also in Ultimate Spinach. Shout out. He's the guy, if you remember.
Yes,
yeah, he ended up becoming he ended up becoming a missile defense contractor.
Yes.
But yeah, they got Skunk Baxter to play the solo on Hot Stuff. And it, like, when you listen to it, it sounds like it belongs in a Steely Dan song. Like, totally. It's perfect for what it is. That mesh of rock and disco, it's groovy. It's kind of dirty, kind of fuzzy, and it's like, yeah, this is the tone that you want to strike when you're trying to mix disco and rock.
We touched on it a little bit, but the first half of this album as a capsule is insane. You could play it track to track to track as one solid dance DJ set, and you wouldn't have a single miss. Every single song is so good. They all could have easily been huge singles. And I think this was one of her biggest years for chart topping singles.
It's huge. Yeah. I would imagine as far as hits per album, it's gotta be pretty
high. It's up there. It's up there. For sure.
The song Walk Away. This is a little bit of tea that we're going to
please.
The song Walk Away was the final single that was released, and it is almost definitely rooted in Pettiness.
Go.
Okay. So, shortly after this record releases, Donna Summer leaves Casablanca. It's a pretty highly public situation.
Yes.
She signs with Geffen. And right around the time that she's gearing up for her first single, or excuse me, for her first record to release on Geffen, Casablanca releases Walk Away as the final single from Bad Girls. And they then follow that up like a week or two later with a compilation album.
Yes.
Walk Away, you know, the same title, basically to tank her first record on Geffen.
Trashy. So,
and also just to milk, because, you know, by that time, we're going into 1980, disco is like spiraling the drain. So they're trying to get everything they can.
Well, I know that, too, she made that one of her biggest hits on the radio for the movie Foxes. Mm-hmm. And it was at first only exclusively released through that soundtrack. But then shortly after, maybe like 6 months after Bad Girls came out, they put out on the radio Greatest Hits Volume 1 and 2 just so they could release on the radio and as like a big album. And then shortly after that, when they re-released Bad Girls, they put it as a bonus track. So clearly they were like really trying to sell the shit out of anything Donna Summer that they had still.
Because, you know, 1979, she's massive. She's a worldwide star. And for them to lose her to Geffen, that's a huge hit to their bottom line. So they were just going to.
And not only did they lose her, it was an enormous lawsuit.
Yeah.
Very public lawsuit.
Dim All the Lights, the song Dim All the Lights.
Oh my gosh.
It rules. This was part of the dispute, or the bad blood. centers around this song. The song was originally written for Rod Stewart, but then Donna Summer was like, well, I wrote this and it's way too good, so I'm going to keep it. I think it's Bad Girls and Hot Stuff have already gone to number one. They're boom, boom, boom. And she had Dim All the Lights, released it. It was moving up the charts. She was like, this is going to be my third number one. Like, let's just let this ride. She had also recorded a duet with Barbra Streisand.
Yes.
And she like went to Casablanca Records and was like, can you not release this until Dim All the Lights peaks? And they were like, yeah, of course. And then they jumped the gun by a month and released it early. And Dim All the Lights peaked at number two. And eventually the duet with Barbra Streisand went to number one, because, I mean, why wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But that would make me salty.
You think?
That I would be a little bit salty if I was in line for my third consecutive number one single from the same, from the same record. And my label was like, yeah, no, that's fine. And then they undercut me. I would be.
Oh, it seems that there is a lot of bad blood between them. I have a quote of hers here where she's talking about why she feels that she feels like the lawsuit was necessary. And she says that she just wasn't justly compensated for all that she had done for them. She'd sold millions of records and she'd not been paid for them still.
Yeah, that would be, I would consider signing elsewhere.
Yeah, which she did. I also want to, first of all, are you going through the track list one by one?
Not one by one.
Okay, because I want to give a quick shout out to the transition between Journey to the Center of Your Heart and One Night in a Lifetime. I listened to that tiny little one note stinger between those two songs like crazy. It just sits so perfectly. It's so well coordinated. Okay, I want to talk about another song that's a huge hit from this album. It's called Our Love.
Yeah.
It is a later song on the album, and it's one of the more upbeat songs of the later tracks. And Our Love influenced Blue Monday by New Order, which is the best-selling 12-inch single of all time. Bassist Peter Hook has come out and said point blank that he was influenced by Marauder as well as like Kraftwerk and Sparks, but that the drum beat was basically stolen from Our Love.
It's not subtle.
Yeah.
When you listen to it, it's not subtle.
And again, the second I realized that, it was so clear. It's everybody has heard this song. It's in tons of movies. He also mentioned that the bass line was inspired by the cadence from the main theme of Morricone soundtrack.
Oh, that's cool.
It's the For a Few Dollars More with Clint Eastwood.
We're talking about all these tracks. What I think is so profound about the kind of theme of this record is like the empathy that is not given to these sex workers, but like Donna Summer was an actor, right? She was. There's plenty of quotes of her saying that she is an actor who sings, and that when she, you know, performs a song, she steps into the role.
She says, I'll alter my voice for the song as opposed to altering the song for my voice.
Right. There you go. And that, like, when you are stepping into the role of a sex worker, you then have a job to do to tell that story honestly and to do so with, like, due diligence and like, no judgment. Mm-hmm. And, like, the song, like, Bad Girls is not passing judgment on the folks that are engaged in this type of work, which is unique for the time.
It was not a very topical subject at the time. It was pretty taboo.
Yeah, and if it was spoken on, it was not very kind to the sex workers. And to step into that role and to do so... And to do so with kindness and empathy And then to make it a pop hit, that's impressive.
Yeah.
That's really extraordinary. And then to take the whole album and make it like an entire like monster.
Talk about bringing attention to an issue that needs to be addressed.
And like wrapping important issues in 3.5 minute pop songs. It just, you know, if what you're hearing, if a song that is stuck in your head is addressing things that need to be talked about, that's pretty effective pop music.
Yeah. She says here it was a new thing for her to think about. This wasn't something she had spent a lot of thought thinking about. Yeah. She hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about this, but when her assistant brought it up to her, she has this interview after the album released where she says there's a place on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. Maybe you're familiar.
Yeah, you know, I've been to Sunset.
Yeah. Where a lot of real bad girls, and I don't know, it made me start thinking, and I mean, I guess they're not really bad girls. In some way, they're just trying to make a living, you know? And if there was no need for them, they obviously wouldn't be there. So who am I to judge?
There you go.
And especially to have a woman in a position of power coming out and being so straightforward. At the time, it was very unusual and very cool.
It is, and it's still cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's still cool.
The message and the music, right?
Yeah.
Because that is the appeal of a record. Like if you put Bad Girls on today, it still sounds fresh. Mm-hmm. It's obviously of its time, right? Like it's made in 1979. You can't escape that. But Hot Stuff is always going to kick. Yeah. Our Love is always going to kick. Bad Girl, like who? It's cool.
Yeah.
It's cool. It is like, it compels you to move while also telling you, it compels you to move while also putting into your head this idea that people deserve basic empathy.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's a radical idea. I know.
But how hard to do both things in one record that also is a full, chock full of chart topping hits?
Yeah. And never comes across heavy handed, right? That's it's a tough needle to thread. And to do so smoothly is a real achievement.
Now, I think we should talk about the fact that at the time, not everybody felt the same way that we do now. And it sort of brought about the exactly what you said, rapid decline of disco in modern culture.
So this is utterly fascinating to me because like, where does this album fit in our history, right? And it fits in a very specific and unique time. Because this album was released in April of 1979. In July, 2 months, not even, of 1979, there's this event that is held at Comiskey Park, which is where the White Sox play, in Chicago.
Well, can I lead it up?
Oh, please build it up.
Can we talk about how this event came to be?
Yes.
Because, okay, so there's this DJ, Steve Dahl, and he's a rock DJ for a local radio station, WDAI, and he's fired when his radio station decides to go full disco. They don't want to play any more rock hits, and he is very upset about this. But he finds a new job at a different radio station, and he makes his new thing as his new radio DJ job that he hates disco, and that's his entire persona now. He constantly asks people to call into the radio station and request their favorite DJ hits so he can start playing them for a second and then play an explosion sound and break the record live on air.
Hell yeah.
He's so
cool.
So at the time, people who are really into the rock scene of the 70s, you know, there's all of the classic rock hits that we know today. were starting to get really frustrated about the popular takeover of disco and felt like a lot of the bands that they loved were being brushed aside. And Steve Dahl decided to capitalize on this.
Yeah.
So Dahl teams up with this guy named Mike Veek, whose dad, Bill, owned the Chicago White Sox and Kaminsky Park, where said event took place.
Yes.
Do you want to take it away?
I would love to take it away.
Oh, let's go.
The event was called Disco Demolition Night. And the conceit of the event was, if you bring a disco record, admission is 98 cents. And in between games of the doubleheader, they're going to take all these disco records and they're going to blow them up. And that was their response to the dominance, the radio dominance of disco.
And the disco sucks revolution that is still around today somehow.
So, yeah. This thing does not go quite as planned. It's hard to believe that
shocking.
You get a bunch of fans under the umbrella of one thing sucking.
Yeah. That
they're not super reasonable. So the fireworks go off. Everything explodes. The people then rush the field, start setting bonfires and throwing trash and records everywhere. And the second game has to be canceled because the field's so torn up. There were 39 people arrested and over a dozen injured. There's 50,000 people that have come to this event just to blow up disco records.
Well, you know, they expected a crowd of like 35,000 people, and they warned their security team of that. And their security team laughed in their face, thinking, that many people are never going to show up. Of course, they get up almost twice that amount of people, which they weren't prepared for at all. And then Steve Dahl comes out onto the field in a military Jeep, with no speech prepared. I have a quote where he says, "Since I didn't think anybody was going to be there, I had no prepared remarks, so I just yelled stuff."
He sounds like a cool guy.
Absolutely. They explode the records, and all of a sudden, everybody's burning all the banners, vandalizing the stadium. It's totally out of control, and apparently, a lot of people started, the crowd was so wild that a lot of people started bringing in records that weren't even disco records.
Yeah,
they
Al
were
Green
disco adjacent, yeah. You know, soul records, things that had absolutely nothing to do with that, and they lost control of the crowd and couldn't do anything about it.
I, for one, am shocked that
would... Oh, I know. They sound like such a reasonable crowd.
And this is a flashpoint in the national turning point against disco. Mm-hmm. And this anti-disco sentiment had been bubbling under the surface for a little bit. And to an extent, I can understand if all you hear on the radio is disco. It would get a little bit...
That was an excellent shout out to the song. Continue.
Oh, on the radio. I didn't even mean to do that.
Nice.
Wow.
Nice, smooth.
I'm awesome. But if that's all you hear, I could get a little tired of it. This was a flashpoint for the national backlash against disco. These kind of things had been... Like, this sentiment had been bubbling under the surface. It had been increasing over the last few years because of disco's dominance on the radio, which I can empathize with to a degree. Mm-hmm. I think that the viewpoint that it was so dominant that rock acts were getting muscled out is a little disingenuous. Mm-hmm. I don't think that...
They shouldn't be in competition. Well, it should be supportive.
Like, do we really believe that Led Zeppelin was taking it in the pockets because Donna Summer was... No. Like, come on now. Like, let's be really reasonable. The article that I mentioned earlier by Gillian Frank, I don't know the correct pronunciation, is called Discophobia, Anti-Gay Prejudice in the 1979 Backlash Against Disco. It's an incredible article. I would... strongly recommend.
You know what? I think I actually read that too. That's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was really good from the security guard's perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's so, it's really, really informative hearing folks who were there mm-hmm. that felt scared.
Yeah.
That, like, not only were these records being blown up,
but people were threatening them threatening to their face. Them
and bringing in records that, like you said, that yeah. weren't disco records. That speaks to something much, much larger as to the root of this backlash. And I don't want to say that it was the sole cause of the anti-disco backlash, but it is imperative that we look at, or at least mention, that a lot of the anti-disco sentiment was rooted in anti-gay and anti-black.
Absolutely.
Bad Girls, Donna Summer, disco was a safe haven for
people who wanted to celebrate themselves yes. and the people around them.
And I think that it's incredibly telling that you have an album like Bad Girls that is released in April. And 2 months later, this flashpoint happens. And by the end of the year, maybe a calendar year, disco is dead. After the disco demolition night, similar events start popping up. And disco as a genre on the chart is gone. It is absolutely gone. And like we've talked about this before, genres dying off or losing chart prominence is not uncommon. It happens all the time. Look at where rock is now compared to how hip hop dominates the charts, mm-hmm. right? Grunge all but killed hair metal at the time. It is rare, if ever, that a genre of music is forced off of the charts with the violence and vitriol that accompanied the end of the disco era. It's incredibly unique, and it's important that we really, really appreciate the danger and the lack of like humanity that went into it, because that's what it is. Like you said, these people, like the folks that connected with disco, were looking this is self-love, right? And I'm gonna get a little bit crazy out of here. I like to think about, like, the 70s are a hangover. The 70s are the 60s hangover, right? Where like the 60s are all about projecting your love outwards, peace, love everywhere. And the generation that follows that is so tired and so done with loving everybody else that they're looking for music that is about taking care of yourself and loving yourself. And that's yeah. disco.
In a place, in a world that didn't take any steps to take care of them. They need to take care of each other. All of the communities that Donna Summer's music supported actively and created a safe space for.
Disco is a selfish music in a good way.
Yes.
It compels you to move. It asks you to find where the music resonates in your body. And I think that calling it escapist is kind of a clever way of detracting from what it really provides and what it has provided to many, many, many folks before it. And yeah, like I can't imagine hating something enough to
that you have to punish others for it.
To pay a dollar to go watch other people blow up records. Like that's yeah. just
especially when, you know, at this time especially, classic rock was not creating a safe space for any of these people, you know? Yeah. It was dangerous for a lot of people to go to a classic rock show, and the fact that these same people who are benefiting from being able to go wherever they like and listen to whatever music they want are also choosing to take away the happiness and safety of others. It's not... it's a trend that I hope will not continue, and I hope disco isn't going to be forgotten as a genre because of the motivation of these people at the time.
Yeah, I think that now like as we've moved further and further away from it, disco, I don't think it'll ever be as prominent as it was in the mid to late 70s, but the tide has kind of turned way more in favor of disco. I mean, when you have like Daft Punk is obviously super, super influenced by Giorgio Moroder.
They worked with Moroder.
Yeah, they worked with it. And like, if not disco exclusively, the disco influence is everywhere in pop.
It's true, everywhere in pop.
And it should be, because it's feeling music.
And it's all about embracing yourself for exactly who you are, every part of yourself.
And Donna Summer and Bad Girls did that better than just about any other disco record. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
I think that's all we got on that record. That's all we got. Why don't we do some plugs in GTFO?
That sounds good to me.
Hey, thank you guys. You know, if you're listening, if you've made it through to this point, thank you for taking this kind of meandering journey on the pilot. We're going to tighten things up and, you know, trim moving forward. But check us out on all of our socials. We've got, how about you just hit us up with some socials?
All right. Well, you guys can email us at earwaxpodcast@amoeba-music.com. That's for anything you need to get a hold of us about. If you wanted to add anything to something that you've heard today, or if you have any suggestions for us in the future, you can hit us up there. You can also check out our Instagram and TikTok, or Amoeba has a Facebook and Instagram. Each location has their own Facebook and Instagram. So Amoeba Berkeley, Amoeba SF, and Amoeba Hollywood. Amoeba Hollywood also has its own TikTok page. And you can always sign up for our email list if you want to know about contests, coupons, or any other updates for the store locations.
Amoeba.com has free shipping on music and movies. So if you can't get into the store, you can check out what we've got online. And then also head on over to YouTube and check out our What's in My Bag series. It's pretty sick. Other than that, that's it. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And we'll see you next week. And no.
Just, we'll see you around the store.
say that. Sorry, say it again. I talked over you.
No. Oh, no. You say it. Because it was in the middle of your thing.
Oh. Yeah. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you around the store.